Dyson, Senator Stedman, and Coach Al Wilken have joined me today for the hearing on several pieces of legislation. And we've also been joined by Senator Charlie Huggins, and Member Bundy is also here with us. And the first item we have this morning is SJR 14, which has been sponsored by Senator Huggins. It's not a transportation or anything. Okay, it's an individual bill. If you would go ahead and present this piece of legislation to us, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Deborah Grunman, staff to Senator Huggins. Thank you for allowing us to be here today. Before you, Senate Joint Resolution urging the United States Congress to amend the tax code to permanently repeal the federal estate and generation skipping transfer tax. The estate of a deceased individual is required to pay a tax to the federal government, commonly known as the death tax. This tax is on assets that have been previously taxed, and then requiring the survivors to pay taxes on those assets again through an inheritance tax. In 2005, the top tax is 47% with a $1.5 million exclusion. This is a tax that has negative impacts on family businesses, on small businesses, on small ranches and farms, where the goal is passing those on to the children. In 2001, Congress enacted bipartisan legislation to phase out and eventually repeal the death tax until 2010. Therefore, in 2010, the state tax is repealed. However, it springs back to life in 2011 at its old rate of up to 55% and at an exemption level of only $1 million. President Bush has included the permanent repeal of the estate tax in the fiscal year 2006 budget, and legislation has been introduced in the U.S. Senate and the U.S. House. Information that I received today, the U.S. House is scheduled to vote on the permanent repeal of the estate tax possibly today. It would really be nice if we could show them our support for this legislation. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Did you have anything to add to that, Senator Huggins?
Well, Senator Green, thank you. Debbie told me my job is to come here today, smile, and look important, and probably if I did anything more than that, I might mess it up.
And you're supposed to get back to judiciary and do judicial things.
That's
okay.
Correct.
We have several members this morning who have bills before us that are going to piggyback in judiciary. And that's it. But we need a member. Oh, go ahead.
Senator Green, excuse me, if I might, though. I'm certain that each of the members that I see sitting around the table today understand the impact of what we're supporting here today. And it, you know, once again, I've used this term before, but it falls into the right thing to do category. It's common sense, and we realize, and I think we would share the perspective that this is an unfair tax that's been levied on families across the United States over time, and it's time for it to end. And we're just, in this case, trying to emphasize that to the Congress to put it to bed, put a nail in the coffin.
Any questions? Senator Stedman. To the members, please be sure you, and to everyone at the table, be sure you have your mic near you and that you're not putting your hand over your face as you speak. Go ahead.
Yes, Madam Chair, I support this resolution. The only issue I have with the support of it is more on the federal side, is that at some point, there should be an estate tax or a death tax if it's a net worth of $10 million, $20 million, $50 million, you know, some number to slow down the concentration of wealth that we had that we ended up having in the late 1800s, where we had a handful or a relatively small percentage of people controlling the vast majority of the wealth in the country, and that's why the tax was implemented. So, you know, I agree with moving the limits up and abolishing them for the average or even higher than the average Alaskan or nationwide. You know, the farmers come up all the time as far as the value of farmers in Alaska. It's the value of fish permits and boats and or real estate or small businesses. But at some point, there should be a cap, and the tax should be implemented. Otherwise, we're going to have a handful of people and a couple of generations controlling most of the wealth in the nation. And I think that's one of the concerns that have been brought forward by some of the extremely wealthy people, including the Gates family.
And they want to pay a tax?
That's my understanding, that they oppose the permanent exemption from all residents, because when you have hundreds of millions or billions, and that can be transferred from generation on top of generation, that's a whole different issue than trying to shield from estate taxes or death taxes the value of a family business, a small family business. Appeal or repeal of the estate tax was implemented, it was for the entirety, but that debate, or that issue should be on the table. I don't oppose this, because it's an issue that's going to be handled in Washington, but it is an issue that I don't think is a national policy. It's good to concentrate the vast majority of wealth in a handful of families.
And that might be something for follow-up with in the future. Senator Wilken.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Two things. This Friday, all of us will pay estimateds or pay our income taxes, and those are always tough checks to write, but at the same time, we write them, and we're proud to write them, because we live in a wonderful country that is free and protected, and that's why we do those things. I'll tell you, one of the toughest checks I've ever written was the check I had to write. My mom died in 2000, my dad died in 2002. You know, and they were just middle-class family that owned a little one-horse business, owned their house, had a few investments, raised three boys that took all the money they had. And so when they passed on, they had a little estate. And you added it all up, and damned if the federal government wasn't sitting there after them putting into the pot for their whole life, paying their taxes just like we do. Damned if I didn't have the federal government to write a little check to, and it wasn't much. You know, I mean, they didn't have a big estate, but it was enough to just get over the top to qualify. So they die, and I have to write a check. And that was just, it was almost a check that made you ill. And then I think of myself, I had a business, have a little more than my mom and dad did, that's the way it ought to be. And so what I do in my business is, in Senator Stedman, I think the rest of you probably do the same thing. I have to buy life insurance in order so when I die, my wife dies, and the estate passes on to my kids, they don't have to liquidate all these things in order to write a check to the government. And I've been paying my taxes since I was hired at 14. And so here I sit, small business guy, trying to get ahead, employ people, and part of my cash flow every year is to write a check to the insurance agents, insurance companies. So I'm supporting the life insurance people so I can protect myself from my government when I die. You know, it is so convoluted, and Senator Stedman's right. This was put in when the Abercrombies and the old railroad magnates, and the Rockefellers and all that stuff. That was the time for this. But this is, if you want to get after those folks, go ahead, because I'm not at that level. But I'm talking about small business people. I'm talking about mom and pops just like mine that worked hard all their life. And when they die, you've got to pay the government. And people that live today have to protect themselves from the government by supporting the life insurance industry. Mm-hmm. This is just a crime in our society, and thank goodness we're trying to do something about it. So that's my speech. The other thing is, when this came through, Senator Stedman, maybe about 5 or 6 years ago, it got to the Senate floor. And it died because someone asked the question, well, this was back when we were working on the five-year plan, asked the question, what does it do to the general fund? And it had a general fund decrement, so it just never, that killed it and never got life again. So I guess I would ask that, Debbie, so we don't have to wrestle with that again.
Through the chair, thank you, Senator Wilken, and thank you for that eloquent speech. That was very good. Actually, I have Mike Williams on with the Department of Revenue. There is zero fiscal impact because 123104, the credit was which they based the state tax off. It ended due to the legislation that I mentioned in 2001 in Congress. And if Mike would like to add to that, he could do so. Mike?
Mike Williams?
Yes, Madam Chair, this is Mike Williams. I'm an auditor with the Alaska Department of Revenue. And for the record, to the chair and members of the committee, there is, at present, under the current federal structure, there would be no fiscal impact to the state general fund if the federal estate tax were permanently repealed because of the phase-out provisions of the state death tax credit and Alaska adopting those federal provisions after December 31st, 2004, the state would not receive any estate revenue from anybody passing away after that time frame. Now, if we go far enough out, that if the federal estate tax does spring back to life in 2011, then most likely at some point in after fiscal year 2012, we would probably return to the to getting some kind of a estate tax in the range of about $2 million a year.
Can I answer your question?
Yes, thank you. That's a good answer. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Mike. Any other questions for the sponsor? Yes.
I have one other quick comment just to add to what Dr. Wilken said. If you happen to have some parents or family members or yourself that passes away, you have a very tight time horizon to come up with the money for the IRS. And a lot of times what ends up happening, if you're not prepared for it, like Senator Wilken with some life insurance or like myself, I have the same mechanism. Your family is going to be selling off assets at fire sale prices to keep the IRS from knocking on your door. And I know several families that's happened to. And I think that's a horrible thing for working people to work their entire life, not plan for this event, pass away, and then have the IRS knocking on their door 9 months or sticking or enforcing the family to put for sale signs out. So with that, Madam Chair, I support this resolution.
Senator Higgins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If I could just lend one other example. My wife hails from Nebraska, farm country, kind of the food basket of our country in some respects. And most of us are aware that a number of those small farms, which we pride ourselves in across the nation, have passed down over the years through families. And unfortunately, one of the difficulties those families have faced is based on the appreciation of land, though when you look at the cost to those families, if you go to fence posts, you can probably see signs of fingernails and blood drops from the hard work of the family there. And the people that work those farms wear overalls and drive old beat-up pickup trucks. When the key person in the family passes away and they get their notice from the IRS, it is paying to them, and the net effect is, and all too often, some of that acreage goes to someone else, and that farm becomes smaller or goes away. That is a bad thing for our country. It is a bad thing for us to condone, and it's an important thing for us to support that continuation to stop.
Are there any other questions? We have one more witness on that. Net, did you have something, Senator? Go ahead, Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Certainly, as we look at the issues that have been brought up here at this table, and looking at what Senator Wilkinson says, well, Senator Stedman, when you go ahead and have money and investments that taxes have already been paid on, nobody wants to pay any more taxes on them. I agree with Senator Seekins, but or Senator Wilkins. But the difficulty that I have is when you look at how do we make sure that the super monopolies don't again prevail, as was pointed out by Senator Stedman, so that the Carnegies and J.P. Morgan and those people don't monopolize a fair amount of the nation's wealth. Obviously, the worst one that I can think of as you look at the history was John Rockefeller. Here is a guy that took advantage of what was out there and did everything lawfully until Teddy Roosevelt came along and did at least something to go ahead and equilibrate everything. I'm assuming that this resolution does that. Is that not the case?
Well, number one, I don't know the Rock, I don't know any of the Rockefellers and other tycoons of sorts, and my family certainly does not represent that. But I feel reasonably certain that the Rockefellers of the world have a fleet of lawyers that will take care of that. This will not affect their lifestyle in any shape, fashion, or form because they know how to structure their accounts, businesses, and practices so that the net effect on them is zero, would be my assumption. What we're talking about is average Americans that, though they may not drive a Mercedes, they may in fact drive a beat-up pickup, but their net assets cause them to have to fork over some money to the IRS. So what the target here, and we just have to be practical to understand that average Americans that are not dressed in pinstripe suits and walking up down the streets in investment centers, these are average Americans that have assets that will cost them and cause a breakup that they have sweat equity in, and it's not based on a fleet of business enterprise people and investments that they've accumulated wealth, because those major wealth accumulators, they have a fleet of legal expertise that will make them immune to most IRS kinds of things.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That answers my question.
Thank you very much. Senator Dyson.
Thank you. I appreciate the sponsor bringing this forward. I've been part of this discussion here. And the federal government has antitrust monopoly legislation laws in place that I think prohibits the accumulation of power in the marketplace, and I have great confidence in that, and I take great exception to the idea that it's a responsibility.
And if Senator Steakins comes up, we will then switch to that bill, and so we can make our changes. Go ahead, Debbie.
Okay, thank you.
We're on Senate Bill 158, Muni Tax on State Construction Contracts.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Deborah Grundman, staff of Senator Huggins. Senate Bill 158 is an act prohibiting the imposition of municipal sales and use taxes on state construction contracts and certain subcontracts and providing for an effective date. During the course of business in the last couple of years, subcontractors in the construction industry who work in some areas of the state have experienced negative financial impact due to the imposition of local sales tax on state DOT-funded projects. These taxes have been assessed on the value of the subcontract. We are not talking about the purchase of incidental materials, the renting of equipment, the purchasing of food or lodging. Those items would be taxed. Again, we are talking about the construction contract or subcontract that is being taxed. The state cannot afford to have an increase in the cost of construction projects due to the levying of sales tax on state construction contracts and subcontracts awarded directly in connection with the project funded under the construction contract. While all municipalities do not assess the sales tax, and many municipalities do have tax caps, the policy needs to be consistent statewide. Senator, do you want me to continue, Senator Steakins, here? Okay.
No, just
a brief example on a Nome Airport project. It was an $8 million project. It was awarded to Quality Asphalt Paving. Quality Asphalt Paving had Diamond Electric. They entered into a subcontract in connection with the project funded under the construction contract, and Diamond Electric was assessed a sales tax of over $20,000 on the value of their subcontract. This was unexpected and not considered in their bid. Senate Bill 158 will prohibit the imposition of muni taxes and use tax on state construction projects or contracts and certain subcontracts and remedy the inequity that exists.
Thank you very much. And as we said, once Senator Stepney got here, we would switch to his bill. Now that we've completed your presentation, we'll set this aside and come back to it when we have worked on the fish hatchery bill.
Okay.
Thank you, Debbie. So we'll set aside Senate Bill 158 for a few moments. And Senate Bill 147, sports fishery facility revenue bonds. And that's 147. Welcome, Senator Seekins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's a pleasure to appear before this committee on the top floor of the state capitol. I understand everything rolls downhill from here.
I was going to ask if you would add that. Thank you.
But the I have you have before you Senate Bill 147, and as you know, it's a bill that is looking at how we can address the problem of increasing demand and dwindling supply ability for sport fish in the state of Alaska. Comes down to more people want to fish, but particularly that when they go fishing, they'd like to catch. That's what my grandchildren tell me. They like to fish, but Grandpa, they're really happy when they come home after they've caught something. A number of years ago, in the interior, the department closed what was called the Clear Fish Hatchery at Clear Air Force Station that used hot water from the power plant there to help enhance the growth of baby fish. And so the only remaining hatcheries for sport fish in the state of Alaska were at Elmendorf Air Force Base and Fort Richardson in Anchorage. Those fish hatcheries are about 30 years old. They're reaching the end of some of their useful life. They're losing their hot water source from the power plants at Fort Richardson and Elmendorf Air Force Base this October, which means their biomass production capability is going to go down. So in the face of increasing demand, and the possibility or the absolute probability that we will not be able to produce the same biomass, we're starting to hit at a point in time where we are facing somewhat of a crisis in being able to provide that biomass. So a number of years ago, the people of the interior in the Fairbanks area started taking a look at what they could do to be able to get the stocked fish supply biomass higher, and how we could utilize certain assets or liabilities even in the community to become assets. One of the things that in the downtown area, they have the Aurora Power Plant. That power plant gives off a great deal of waste hot water that goes into the Chena River, keeps the river open. Actually, we have ducks that overwinter in Fairbanks, which is an amazing feat, if you ask me. So we started talking with some of the local folks, the mayors of the community, the fishing groups, the federal government, the Army, Senator Stevens, and said we have an increasing number of people, especially military people, moving into the interior, and we need to be able to provide that biomass. So Senator Stevens said, well, we've never done anything with a state hatchery for sport fish before, but after listening to what we were presenting in terms of challenge, he said, well, I think maybe we could help. So Senator Stevens has come up with $10 million from federal money to help in the sport fish hatcheries there. But what we've got is, as we started to take a look at that, the people in Anchorage said, well, you know, for the south central area of the state, from Glen Allen all the way over to the west, all through that area, we're losing the ability to produce that biomass as well. Could we talk about a statewide solution to a statewide problem? And I said, yes. I mean, if we can plan forward into the next couple of decades and do this right so that we don't have to do it again, let's see what that would take. What you have before you is that proposition. A major expansion and renovation of the facilities at Fort Richardson and Elmendorf Air Force Base, and a new fish hatchery in the Fairbanks area. As we started to take a look at that, we found out it's not cheap to do this, but it is affordable. And with the federal funds that have been procured to help, some in the Anchorage, Elmendorf area, I think there's some sustainable salmon funds that will come into there, and with the funds from the federal government, and taking a revenue bond package and then applying a modest, what we would call fisheries enhancement fee, added to the price of a fishing license until those bonds are paid off, We figured that the, we found out that the combined price of a fishing license and the enhancement fee would still be a bargain compared to other states across the nation, especially when a person can actually expect to catch some fish. But doing nothing is not an acceptable option, because it only leads to substantially reduced fish stocks in our lakes and streams. And so I have brought to you today for your consideration and discussion this proposal, which would build fish hatcheries that would, should sustain us well in past 20 years, 20 to 25 years, based on increasing growth in the state and demand, and that will help us plan for the future as well as alleviate the current problem we have. Tell you just how serious that problem is, we expect that before we can get these hatcheries enhanced, expanded, and built, that our biomass production is going to go down and we will lose the ability to be able to meet that biomass production for a short period of time. We hope to be able to bring that back. When I ran the numbers, as you see in the bill, and when I ran the numbers, we found that we could pay off this bond issue by using a proposed fee of about $7.50 for most of the fees for the additional surcharge. We added a dollar to that, anticipating that we're going to have some drop in fishing licenses because we're not going to have production, and there may be some people that don't want to pay the additional $7.50, so we brought it to $8.50 with the understanding that when these bonds are paid off, that the surcharge will go away. So if we pay it off a little bit sooner, that'll work. We're still at the point where our fishing license, an annual fishing license, is less than $25. I'm more than willing to answer any questions on the bill. I just want to emphasize the fact that this concept is meant to be a statewide concept. And I think this is, we're looking at other ways to enhance some of the sport fish production capacities in Southeast as well as South Central and the Northern regions. I'd be more than glad to answer any questions, Madam Chair.
Any questions, Senator Hoffman?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. You say this is a statewide problem. I don't know if it's a statewide problem out in the chain, the Bristol Bay area, that some of the world-class fisheries exist, and you say this also is a statewide solution, and people throughout the state would benefit. How does this affect people, and what benefit would they get in southwestern Alaska?
Southwestern Alaska, the production would be available for being able to stock rivers, lakes, streams, as well, and be able to transport them by aircraft into those areas. If we had the extra production to be able to do so, we'll be able to enhance those fisheries as well. I know some of those are world-class fisheries already. We anticipate that there will be increased pressure on them, and this is an enhancement program. So I would say that now, Senator Hoffman, that we would have the available biomass to meet those additional demands, that the department will meet those demands. They're going to basically be able to say, where do you want fish, and we can provide them.
And who would be deciding the allocation of these quote-unquote new fish?
The sport fish department. I think someone, let's see, we got someone from sport fish that's here. I can tell you that so far, the people in the Department of Fish and Game are very excited about being able to use enhancement programs any place that wants them. And with this capacity, we will be able to do that.
Give your name, please.
Yes, Madam Chair. My name is Rob Bentz. I'm the Deputy Director for the Division of Sport Fish, Fish and Game. And to respond to your question about who decides, where these hatchery fish go. The department, or our division, every year, we come out with a new version, and we call it a five-year stocking plan, that we make recommendations on what fish go to what places, by species, into what lakes or what rivers, and that is sent out to the public, to advisory committees around, throughout the state, and we have, we hold meetings with the advisory committees with some of the sport fishing groups that show an interest, and we take their comments, and so they have, the public has input also on where they go. Thank you, Madam Chair.
And Rob, does the infrastructure exist? I mean, the planes to fly this stock out presently? And if not, is the funds necessary to do that included in this legislation?
I would tell you that the funds to do that are not in this legislation. This is a bond issue for construction only. The funds that are used, and I'm not speaking for the department, primarily come from the Fish and Game Fund and from contributions through Dingell, Johnson, the other names, the federal funds that come there. And I'm not speaking for the division, but before I got into this, I did get the commitment, Senator Hoffman, I'll let them speak, from the director, that the funds for operation and maintenance are available. And to answer that question, even if some of the fish that come into Fairbanks now that are trucked there, they are flown into some of the lakes. The infrastructure is not in the department as much as it is available by hire.
Well, Senator Seekins, I'm trying to figure out, because this legislation talks about an additional $8.50 for sports fishermen throughout the state of Alaska, and I think you're well aware that one of the largest areas of sports fishing activity is in southwestern Alaska. Mm-hmm. So I see that they would be contributing, since they are a vast, a large portion of the industry, they would be, those fishermen would be contributing to this endeavor, and I'm trying to figure out what benefit they would realize as a result of this additional tax.
Well, I would answer that, Senator Hoffman, by through the chair. I would answer that by saying that as demand increases and you need enhancement, it's available through this process. I can't tell you. You could probably tell me better in southwestern Alaska where that demand is needed or that supply is needed to meet the demand. But I will tell you that. The primary dollars that come from this are going to come from non-resident licenses, and a great deal of those non-resident licenses are sold in the interior and south central regions as well, and the southeast. So in some respects, even the people in southeast may not benefit as much from this particular bond issue as they would from some of the other commitments that we've made to be able to help them enhance their fisheries down here as well.
Madam Chairman, that brings up another area, and I wonder if Rob can provide us with exactly where the sports licenses are being utilized throughout the state of Alaska, so we as a committee can get an idea between southeast, south central, northern, and southwestern, and all the state, who would be the ones that would be paying for the additional the fee, and how they might see their benefits. Do you have that information? Is it provided in this document?
I've never asked for that information, Senator Hoffman. I figured that, in general, most Alaskans look at the state as a statewide organization, and that the benefit, even though it may be a greater benefit to some people in some regions, that we've all been willing to pick up the oar and row equally for those things for the rest of the people in the state of Alaska.
No, I guess I would request that information, Madam Chair.
The nature of the information he's requesting for the two of you, Rob?
Madam Chair, I don't have a breakdown of license sales by region. I know Southeast sells approximately 25%. The majority of the licenses are sold in the Cook Inlet, Mat-Su area. One thing in western Alaska, in the northwest Alaska areas, there are some fairly large areas where rod and reel is a the use of rod and reel is a legal subsistence gear type, and therefore the residents that live in those areas are not required to purchase a sport fishing license. As Senator Seekins mentioned, 80% of the increase in revenues that would result from passage of this bill will come from non-residents. And the third point I'd like to just bring out regarding the benefits in areas that currently get any hatchery fish stocked in their areas right now is that approximately 20% of the total sport fishing effort in the state is expended on stocked fish waters, or fish that are either stocked in landlocked lakes or that are released, salmon that are released in anadromous waters. Without new facilities, when the number of these fish declines dramatically, that the 20% of the fishing effort that occurs on them, now those anglers are going to turn to other sources, being wild stocks. And wild stocks throughout the state are either, in almost every case, are either fully allocated, or in the case of resident species, any increase in harvest would probably lead to more restrictive regulations that would have to be enacted. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Does that answer your question, Senator?
Yes, it does, but can't you produce information on who's buying a sports fishing license by zip code? Report of where the sports fishing licenses are being purchased by zip code.
Yes, sir. We can definitely provide you with that information on a town-by-town basis if needed. I just don't have it with me.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Wilken? No, I'm just you.
Sorry, thank you.
Yes,
I did, thanks. Senator Seekins, I'm not sure you said it. If you did, I missed it. I'm sorry. What percent of the licenses are purchased from outside visitors from our state, which would have the effect of paying what percent of this bond obligation?
I tell you, let me just run down through the categories rather quickly. About 115,000 licenses are sold to residents just for sport fishing. That would contribute about $1 million a year. 44,000 for resident sport fishing hunting, 6,000 fishing, hunting, trapping, about 4,200 non-resident military, non-resident one-day sport fishing, about 110,000.
Senator Seekins, could we perhaps refer everyone to the second page of fiscal note number 2?
Right. You can see that breakdown there. So you take a look at, there's about $1.4 million would come from residents, and about $5.1 million from non-residents for the total annual fee surcharge. So the primary group, as you can take a look at in terms of numbers, are the non-resident 1, 3, and 7 day sport fishing licenses as far as the revenue is concerned. These are people that are here for 1 day. A lot of them are only going to go fishing once. We hope they go catching while they're here.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Bundy.
Regarding the question about who's buying license, the data I have isn't current. I did this research probably 8 years ago. But looking at the purchase of Huntington's fishing license statewide, appeared to me in the unorganized areas, rural areas, fewer than 1% of the people bothered to buy hunting or fishing license. Either they don't hunt and fish much, or they ignore the law.
Much too high.
Much too high.
Are there other questions? Are you finished?
Well, and I would just observe that if they're not involved in the activity, I suppose that then their level of concern should be reduced.
Is that a follow-up to to that?
Okay. Follow-up to
You're
my
back
question.
To your question? Okay, go ahead.
So, Senator Seekins, thanks for page 2 of note 2.
So if you do the math, is it correct to say then that non-resident anglers will pay 82% of this bond obligation?
That's correct, Senator Wilkie.
Thank you.
I think it's pretty clear in the proposed rate structure, Madam Chair, that the burden will fall on the non-residents, and I'm certainly not going to put forth an argument that it should go, you know, some other direction. I've got a couple concerns, or actually several, and it's not so much the concept that as we have more and more visitors come up here and we have an increased population, we have more pressure put on our lakes and rivers. And, you know, at some point, we have a concentrated effort, and it appears that's what's going on around Fairbanks, where some of the rivers and streams are in jeopardy of having their wild stocks diminished to a point where they're going to have to, the Fish and Game's going to have to step in, restrict it, close it, or take other measures to protect that base and then come forward with some restocking plan. Is that not fairly adequate?
It's already happened, Senator. There's been the Chena River had to go to a catch and release on grayling. We're already in that position.
Okay. So, you know, I don't have a problem with the concept, and I have more concern, I guess, over the hatchery in and of itself. It seems like privately managed, either through nonprofits or otherwise, run hatcheries seem to be more economically viable than state-operated ones for various reasons. And I recognize there's a difference between a commercial hatchery and a sport fish hatchery. I'd like the Senator Seekins to address why, when the analysis was done, there wasn't reactivation of some underutilized or non-utilized hatcheries in the state, and fish, you know, shipped to various locations where they're needed versus construction of a brand new hatchery. I've got several questions. If I could just have them answer one at a time, Madam Chair.
That'd be fine.
I think, Senator, it was primarily, there's a clear distinction in my mind, and I'll ask the sport fish guys to comment on this well, that there is a difference between the production for sport fish and the production for comfish, as you said earlier. And, you know, you get into those turf wars, and it can be a little bit interesting, to say the least, between people who want to catch the fish for profit and the people who want to catch the fish. I won't say for recreation, because I'm rather than being catch and release, I'm kind of a fillet and release guy myself. But there is two distinct, very distinct
catch and fillet
constituencies there. And so the as we looked at that, and because also the biomass that they're producing is different and would have different requirements, even though in the anchorage hatchery we are putting in a salmon component to be able to restock and also get some landlocked stocks for interior Alaska as well. So I think you get into an area there where there are two distinct different missions between comfish and sportfish, and it was I felt that it was better to try to keep those two missions separated and their production clearly identified for their target markets.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Stedman, I was not involved in the portions of the analysis where if they looked at some of the hatcheries that are either underutilized or not operating in the South Central area. I do know that, as Senator Seekins mentioned, there are major differences with our hatcheries, a sport fish hatchery versus a private nonprofit hatchery, such as you have a number of down here in Southeast. With our resident species, we have to maintain what they call broodstock, the adult fish that we keep all year long there to get the gametes from,
to raise the eggs on an annual basis. You don't do that in a commercial salmon production hatchery such as Ensura has or Sarah. They don't have brood stock. They don't do, they do maybe two or three different species. We do, we've got five or six different species. Each one has to have its own separate water, so its own separate temperature regimes, et cetera, et cetera. So, thank you, Madam Chair.
On that point, ma'am.
Senator Olson.
For the commercial hatchers, then where do we get the gametes from?
Madam Chair, they get the gametes every year from the adult salmon that return. They don't have to keep any fish year-round to do that.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Go ahead.
So then I assume that the department has contacted and worked with the present hatchery operators that are viable and in business today. A lot of them have gone defunct over the years, and there's been some changes. But then I assume that this has been run by the industry, and the industry is not interested in stepping forward and taking care of this dire need for broodstock, either by, or not broodstock, but sport fish, either by retooling one of these underused hatcheries or non-used hatcheries, and or managing it. I assume that's been done?
No, Senator. I'll tell you that right now. We did not go to them and ask to retool. We looked at the central locations to be able to meet the biomass demand. Since we always have already have control of two of those, and we have a local interior hatchery group, the city and borough, that are eager to help provide the location for the third, we basically centrally located those hatcheries and considered them to be a separate mission. So I did never ask that question, to tell you the truth.
Well, I think it's prudent of the Finance Committee to have a cost analysis done on these situations when we're looking at spending tens of millions to put in a new hatchery, and if it's needed, it's needed. We ought to build it. But if we have other avenues to get the job done, then we should at least go through the process and rule them out. And if I could just switch gears a little bit, because again, I don't disagree with the concept of what we're trying to accomplish. I've got some concerns of implementation of it, I guess. And I'm not very familiar with Fairbanks. I've only been there a couple times. But my understanding is, and it may be incorrect, that there's some kind of revitalization, rejuvenation of a particular area in the community. And is this hatchery, you know, how is it going to be integrated into that? If it is, how is it, and what's the component? Is this going to be another way of asking it, is this going to be an industrialized fish growing complex, or is this going to be more of a architecturally pleasing complex that will not only grow sport fish but attract visitors into it?
I've heard those same rumors about how this is some kind of a kingpin to a development. I would tell you that there is this map that's been provided by the borough mayor, who said that the fish hatchery, which would be located over here next to Pioneer Park, which would have a visitor component in it and would have an educational component in it, in cooperation with the University of Alaska School of Fisheries, fully funded by the federal dollars that Senator Stevens has put into it. Would that $10 million brings waste heat from the Aurora plant over here to the hatchery, builds a small visitor component where you could drive a school bus full of kids up there to take a look at the hatchery, would be open for tourism if they wanted to take the walk, the stroll over from Pioneer Park over here, which is a visitor center in the Fairbanks area, to the facility to take a look at how they raise fish. So there can be there is a component that can be used there. It's a multifaceted approach, which was financed with the $10 million in federal dollars. And over here is the Carlson Center. The Carlson Center is where the UAF plays hockey. That's where the conventions take place in the city of Fairbanks.
And the mayor has said that he would like to, over time, improve access to this area. And if you've ever tried to get into the Carlson Center to go to a hockey game with 4,500 yelling, screaming fans, they do as much yelling and screaming on the way in and on the way out, having to deal with traffic. And over here along the river, he would like to develop some additional condominium space, shopping space, et cetera, to enhance this particular area, which right now is a snow dump, the Groudon Baseball Park, a couple of American Legion parks over here, Little League fields over here. This is where the Alaska Gold Panthers play baseball and the American Legion play baseball. So the community is saying, yes, this could be a portion of an improvement in this particular area. The primary reason for the location was the proximity of Burland, city land and Burland, close to the Aurora Power Plant to be able to utilize that hot water heat. And they've given me a letter of commitment to provide that hot water for a minimum of 15 years. So what we have here is, as this became an improvement in the area, and it won't be a commercial building, but if you've ever watched the General Steel advertisements on TV, they say a metal building doesn't have to be ugly. And I think that's probably what the concept of this will be. It's not going to be an architectural edifice, but it's meant to be a functional building that doesn't look like a ball bearing factory. And which we do have one's called the Federal Building in Fairbanks, the ball bearing factory. So it's basically the it's over here next to this visitor facility. It's not immediately in proximity to the development that the borough mayor would like to do, which will require private investment. So I don't think that this is a cornerstone to some future development as much as it's meant to be an accessible hatchery that produces fish but also has some other benefits in terms of research and visitor and education.
I'm sure if I could. I don't necessarily disagree with the concept of integrating tourism but more specifically integrating educational facilities in our hatchery. I think having the kids K through 12 and college being able to go to hatcheries and see the fingerlings and see the process and understand where the fish come from and why the state or through nonprofits have to step in and do hatcheries. I don't have any issues with that concept at all. I don't, being from a substantial distance away from Fairbanks, I don't understand the heating water issue very well. It's down here, the hatcheries I'm more familiar with, they just stick a pipe in the creek and they got all the water they want. Normally too much.
I got a couple of experts here who can help you, but it's basically fish grow faster in warm water.
So, and then you mentioned that you know, the hatchery needs, in this location, needs a supply of hot water, or maybe in lots of other locations also probably. And there's a electrical generation plant that has his waste product of warm water?
Yep, right down about here, Senator, is a big power plant that's a coal-fired hot water, steam-generated power plant. It currently dumps some of its wastewater in here, and this section of the river stays open year-round, even at 45. You remember Representative Stepovich, he used to go, he and the family, the Stepovich family would all go water skiing on the Chena River on January 1st, just to prove that it could be done at 40 below zero. You know, I'd hate to fall in at those temperatures, but and so what's happened is we'll be able to take some of the BTUs out of that water by the time we put it back into the river, helping solve an environmental problem that we have, and also save, what do we figure, about $1 million a year in heat costs? About $1 million a year in heat costs by utilizing this hot water, which is provided to us for free.
But I take it when we look at an analysis of putting a facility together, there's some sort of commitment, which I take as short of a guarantee, of supply of hot water.
That's correct. And the Usabelli Company, Usabelli Coal Mine, owns that power plant.
I don't anticipate they're going to go broke in the next 15 years, but they've said, they've given us a commitment to, for 15 years' worth of hot water supply for the fishery.
It seems that, generally speaking, you know, in projects, you want to tie in your commitments, in this case, a hot water commitment, to your life expectancy of your amortization of your bonds, preferably the length of your project, but at least your debt.
Seekins has something that needs to be, Rose will distribute.
Okay. There's some on that side, Rose.
So I take it this is, well...
This is a letter of commitment, Senator, that I got from Bucky Wright, who is the general manager of the Aurora Energy Company in Fairbanks. And...
Senator Seekins, Bucky Wright is on the off-net.
Oh, is he? We maybe could ask Bucky if my portrayal of this has been correct, if you want, Madam Chair.
Yeah. Bucky, would you like to present your testimony or answer the question if you can?
Did I hit the right button? Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. If you'd introduce yourself and give who you represent, please.
My name is Bucky Wright. I'm general manager of Aurora Energy, LLC, in Fairbanks.
All right. Go ahead.
Senator Seekins, you got a good bit of it right. I've never seen former Representative Stepovich on the river at 40 below, but I imagine that happened. Regarding the plant, we use water from the Chena River in the process of running the steam turbines for cooling purposes. And so the water, we take water out of the Chena River and run it through a heat exchanger to help in cooling in the process there. And so some of the heat is transferred to that water and then it's discharged back into the Chena River. It's a very low-grade heat. So it probably wouldn't be accurate to think of it as hot water. But in the winter months, it's probably going to be 50 to 55 degrees Fahrenheit water that's going to come out of the plant and be discharged back into the river. So that heat is not really good enough to provide space heat needs, say, for people's offices or something. But it turns out that it's very useful, according to the hatchery folks, it's very useful in their process. The fish don't need to be kept in water at a terribly high temperature, but it needs to be consistent. And so the plan is that we would provide that some of that heat that is waste heat that's not, we cannot capture it for our business of selling heat, and it would be made available to Fish and Game. And basically, Senator Seekins said it's free. Well, it's almost free. I guess what we want to be sure of is that we just don't incur cost doing it. So there'll be some cost of putting piping in. There'll be virtually no cost or little to no cost of ongoing maintenance and operation of that. And the heat itself doesn't cost anything. So the cost would be, I'd say, negligible and almost nothing. I'm told that they would need some additional heat just to heat their offices. We would be able to provide that, but we're a regulated utility and would have to provide that on whatever our tariff rate is, but that's a minor part of the heat. And the savings that Senator Seekins mentioned and asked somebody in the room to verify, those are calculations that the department has made, I believe, and I wouldn't know about that. Now, regarding the, can we provide heat for a long period of time? The power plant has been there a long time. The power plant will be there for a long time. We have every intention of expanding the business. We have several projects in the works trying to do that. If the legislature approves the funding for this and the hatchery gets built, then we would have every intention to enter into negotiations to sign a long-term contract with the Department of Fish and Game to provide the heat. And and then how we would go about doing that and how quickly it could, the construction could get done. And I would say a minimum amount of time that that would, that ought to be is 15 years. I mean, it could be longer than that.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Wright. Senator Sedman.
One follow-up, and then I'll be done. But
I could correct that. The savings, annual savings, is considered at about $750,000. I was just, you know, used car salesman was just a little high on the price.
You were ready to negotiate?
Start high.
Well, I think the issue is that, you know, the water supply and are one of the issues, but clearly, you know, Fairbanks is going to need electricity to run their town, so I would imagine that city, it's going to be around a while. If I could, and just recap, Madam Chair, I think it'd be prudent of this committee to have the department do an analysis of the infrastructure that's available and just the standard gamut of why these entities are inferior to the option of construction of a brand new hatchery. And then move forward from there. But
I think, Madam Chair, in that regard, my response would be in communicating with the people from the Department of Fish and Game is that the infrastructure that is available is not of the right design to be able to handle the stocks of fish that would be produced here. And sorry.
Senator Wilkin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple of things. I noticed that the person that has worked on this hatchery and is the expert has come into the room, and I wonder if we might have him come to the table. He probably came in on the 9:30 plane, and I think he can answer a lot of these questions. There's an issue of timing here, and Senator Seekins, if you'd hold up the map again. There's obviously been a lot of work done to get the bonding to where it is and get this bill moving along, and there's been a lot of encouragement. There's it, Senator Seekins, Wilbur Street?
Wilbur Street.
Okay.
Wilbur Street is...
That's the main arterial from Airport Road to the Carlson Center.
Right.
In the bond issue, the bond issue of 2002, there's a major upgrade of Wilbur Street to improve that arterial. Before you can, or in conjunction with the Wilbur Street arterial, there is the Lower Second Avenue upgrade, which is where his pencil is. When they dig up Lower Second Avenue in order to do Wilbur Street, that's the time that they want to lay the hot water pipes to bring hot water to not only to the hatchery, but also to that area. So that project is supposed to be in the ground starting this spring, and they want to lay those pipes. So it's of the essence that this bill get through this year. So if we want to do an analysis of other hatcheries that may perhaps are on the shelf and have been, for whatever reason, set aside, that's fine, but I wouldn't want to have that be drug out to hold this bill up, because we are under the gun, and I think, unless I'm mistaken, from the city, we are under the gun in DOT to get this done. And then I think Gordon can help us with the technical issues.
Certainly.
And your name is?
My name is Gordon Garcia. I am called the Hatchery Guru of the State of Alaska Department of Fish and Game.
Okay, go ahead.
There has been some discussion here about can other hatcheries do the programs that we now do. We did a review of the different facilities in the state, and many of these facilities did belong to the Department of Fish and Game under Fred Division many years ago. The complexity and the different types of fish, species of fish, and the programs that we have almost require that we have specific hatcheries built just to handle the program as we see it. There are hatcheries out there that do raise other fish. For example, in Southeast, we have hatcheries that target anadromous fish. Those might lend themselves better to an anadromous type of a situation, but when we get into the interior, where we are taking fish from a central point and literally dispersing them all across the state, water quality becomes very important. And many of the hatcheries up in the interior do not have a water quality source that is virus-free. In other words, they take their water from lake bodies or stream systems that already have fish in them, and with the fish come a disease component that could detrimentally affect the production at these hatcheries. What we are trying to do with our new facility is basically come up with a bulletproof type of facility that produces a whole range of fish and sizes and species that we would feel comfortable about planting into the different, I think there's some 400 lakes and stream systems in Alaska that we now address with the current facilities that we have.
Further questions, Mr. Chairman?
It's not quite the information I get from some of the hatcheries, similar, but not quite. Also, I think when we look at projects like this, it would be nice even though it's been addressed, to take a look at, you know, what kind of facility are we building for our money. And I think you used the industrialized or the tin box or whatever it was versus a Taj Mahal, or, you know, and I'm not saying that this is a Taj Mahal, so don't misinterpret what I'm saying. For all I know, it may be more like the industrialized architecture of the state building, the SOB, but and I recognize, you know, the comments being made about digging up streets. When you dig them up, you want to dig them up once, layer utilities and be done with it. You don't want to dig them up and repave them and then a couple years later go dig them up again. But I think the issue is a little bigger than that.
Madam Chair, if I could, I've put about 5 years worth of work into this project. Started before I came here, working with the local governments, working with the department, working with the many different user groups, to try to come up with a plan that did not overspend the people's money, but did it in the manner that was designed to produce biomass at the lowest unit cost possible without having an ugly building to do it, and having something that can be utilized on a multifaceted basis. I have never seen a project in Fairbanks since I've been there. I've only been there 31 years. Senator Wilkins been there longer. That has had greater community support than this one, because the people recognize the need, especially with the military expansion that's taking place. These folks are the ones that spend a lot of outdoor time. That's why Senator Stevens also was excited for the first time to bring $10 million to a sport fish hatchery in the history of the United States. We've looked at every way that we can get the most for our dollar without being extravagant, and reach the broadest possible population of the state. We may not get all of the folks over in Senator Hoffman's area the same benefit, but that, I mean, he kind of tacitly admitted just a minute ago that most of them don't buy licenses anyhow. But to reach the broadest possible number of people in the state by having an enhanced fisheries program. This is truly a user pay, user benefit program. Truly, because the people who will be harvesting the fish are paying for it. I believe we've lived up to our fiscal responsibility in doing that. And we've worked hard on this project, myself, for better than 5 years, all 3 years since I've been here. And I would appreciate and I don't have all of the actuarial numbers, but I've had some success in being able to meet demand with supply in the private world, and I think this plan that's set out before you today will do that in a fiscally responsible manner. And to further delay it only does one thing: make sure that we cannot meet the demand and puts us a year farther behind.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, I probably should be supporting something like this, because it'll probably keep a lot of people from going out to rural areas of the state. But
let's tell your tourism people that, okay?
Maybe this is why there may not be as much support for purchasing the Gulawak property because there won't be need to go out there and utilize those banks to fish in such pristine country. But going back and looking at the numbers here for the hatchery, and Senator Seekins talked about stocks, not the right stocks, but for the Anchorage hatchery, there's going to be proposed right around $4 million of salmon out of the $6.4 million there. And when you look at those numbers, an Anchorage facility at $45 million will produce 6.4 million fish, whereas the Fairbanks facility, and I don't know if these are up to date, but that's a $25 million facility, $20 million less than the Anchorage facility, but it's proposed to produce less than a third of a million fish, substantially less. But I, you know, I've been to hatcheries, you know, there's nothing mystical or magical about them. You know, they're big facilities, and you have your raceways, you have your incubators, and, you know, to retrofit something to for changing what type of stock you want, I don't think that's too monumental. You know, and I think that that goes to, you know, and I wonder if the department might comment upon that. When you look at existing hatcheries, which Senator Stedman had talked about, you know, I think that that's something that should be considered, and I wonder if the department might discuss that as well. You know, and I'm not talking about the cost effectiveness between the Anchorage and the Fairbanks hatchery at this point.
Oh, Senator Olson, did you want that question answered, Senator Hoffman, or do you just want the information?
If the department could respond to the concern about using existing hatcheries and retrofitting them to versus building new.
And you're asking that of Mr. Garcia?
Yeah, the department.
R. And your name is?
Madam Chair, my name is Doug Vincent Lang, and I'm the Assistant Director of the Division of Sport Fish.
Doug Lane?
Doug Vincent Lang, V-I-N-C-E-N-T hyphen L-A-N-G.
Thank you.
We looked at the hatchery infrastructure in South Central Alaska, and for the needs of the South Central Interior Program, it's not there. Now, in Southeast Alaska, it is there. It's mostly an anadromous release program. We could have built a hatchery down in Southeast Alaska with the contributions that we're doing towards private nonprofit hatcheries down here, but that didn't make sense to be competing against private nonprofit hatcheries down in Southeast Alaska. It made more sense to use that infrastructure because it was built and could supply the kind of production that we needed on the sport fish side. In Interior Alaska, because of stocking policies, because of disease policies, and a whole variety of other things, the infrastructure that exists up there isn't sufficient to meet the demands for the production that we have for both the Anchorage area and the Interior and Kodiak's area. So we took a look at that, and we determined that the most cost-effective way to move forward into the future is to build new hatcheries in South Central and Interior Alaska.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Question? Senator Olson?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. This is probably a question for Bucky Wright, if he's still on.
Go ahead.
Yes, I'm still here.
You talk about providing the power for Fairbanks, and I was wondering, what's your fuel source for it now?
Fuel source is coal from the East Valley Coal Mine.
And with the idea that the natural gas pipeline is going to be coming through hopefully sometime in the near future, are there plans for using natural gas to produce power, and if it does, how does it affect the warm water that you're going to be producing?
Well, right now, I wouldn't say there are plans. There are certainly folks in the community who are pretty excited about the possibility of having natural gas available, and so it's been talked about as a possibility to replace coal and some of the power plants, and certainly it's been talked about as a supplement for space heat, which would displace oil primarily. But as it relates to power, it would be a result of economics. If gas were available here at lower BTU cost than coal, then it could be pretty attractive. And so I think that you have to wait on that. But when we've looked at it for our power plant, and that's all I can really speak for directly, it hasn't appeared that it would be economically advantageous to switch over to gas. So I'd say that at this point, that's not something we see on the near-term horizon.
Okay, and Madam Chairman, if I could, to the sponsor, what are the plans, assuming that Mr. Wright may be not quite as correct as he would like to be, what are the plans for getting hot water to them if natural gas does come through?
In that case, Senator, through the chair, you'd have to put boilers in to heat hot water.
Is that on that point, Senator Wilkin? Because
yes.
I also have... Okay, go ahead.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Wright, regardless of whether it's coal or gas, there's nobody contemplating taking down Chena 5 power. That's the Fairbanks' major power source, if we're not mistaken. And there's no discussion whatsoever of shutting down Chena 5. Is that correct?
We have a long-term power contract with Golden to provide power to the area co-op, Golden Valley. That goes on for quite some time. Plus, we provide heat to virtually not every single customer in downtown Fairbanks, but most of them. The new hotel in downtown Fairbanks, the new state courthouse building that's just been completed, and in fact they have no other way to put in a different heat source. When they built the building, they didn't have room. So we have every intention of being here for a long time to come.
Thank you.
If I could continue, Madam Chairman. To the sponsor, you talked about the ability to go ahead, and I'm assuming you're talking about flying fish fry out to various parts of the state. If there is a shortage of biomass that's out there, I'm assuming the mechanics of it, you put a tank in an airplane, put the fry in there, fly them out, dump them out. Is that?
That's what I've seen so far. The experts could tell you, but I've seen them transport fish out to some of the off-road lakes in the interior that way.
And where, assuming you're going out to Western Alaska, which is the district that I represent, is transporting fry that distance been successful in the past?
Representative Olson, through the chair, we have transportation of fry down to a science. What becomes problematic, of course, is how much it costs for us to get them out. You know, how do we get the biggest bang for our buck? Most of our out plantings are done on road systems right now because we can transport them in trucks. We take them presently from Anchorage all the way to Fairbanks with very little loss. It is possible to take fish, and we have in aircraft and take them out to more remote lakes.
So in the foreseeable future, I don't anticipate that I'd be flying anything out there, even if there is a shortage.
Madam Chair, this is Doug Vincent Lang with the Division of Sport Fish again. The way we operate our hatcheries are decided upon by the five-year stocking plan. That stocking plan has a public process involved with it. So if there is a need that's identified in areas of the state, the public has an opportunity to identify that need, put it into our stocking policy, and that drives the production capabilities of our hatcheries and where we're going to stock fish. So in essence, if in fact there's a desire in Western Alaska to have fish and it meets and it gets included in this document and it's concurrent with the policies for disease and fish transport and broodstock development, we would certainly consider that. But there's a public process for getting those kinds of stocking into it through this process.
Go ahead, Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. And you bring up the other issue that's kind of key on my mind. What is the, realizing these are going to be set free into the river, what are the plans by the department should a disease become rampant? Because all of a sudden you've got fish that are not just going to be accessible to people here in the state of Alaska, but the Canadians will probably want to go ahead and have some type of input on it, which will probably, or ideas if there is a disease, what are the plans?
Madam Chair, through the chair, Senator Olson, we can't do anything if a Canadian fish comes in and introduces disease into Alaska. But we can prevent those things ourselves. We have an invasive species policy that kind of deals with invasive species outside of Alaska and introductions of fish into Alaska. That guides, for instance, what would happen if a Canadian fisherman, like an Atlantic salmon, would come into Alaskan waters. We would try everything in our way to prevent it and stop it. In terms of our own stockings, we have a lake stocking policy and a smolt stocking policy that dictate that when we stock fish, that they're going to be disease-free, they're from local stocks, and they're not going to result in long-term genetic interference with fish or introduction of diseases. So we have policies that guide that. For instance, we wouldn't take fish from Southeast Alaska and stock them in Western Alaska. We would look for a local broodstock, and we would raise that broodstock and have those fish be the stockings that we have in that area. So we have policies in place to kind of keep diseases in check and movements of fish in check.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Senator Bundy?
Thank you, Madam Chairman.
I remember your question after.
Yes. Just a comment. I'm really heartened by the enthusiastic examination of the and scrutiny of state spending in this particular issue exhibited by my two colleagues to the right here. I'm hoping that will continue when we get to rural subsidies like power cost equalization as to whether that is a good use of state funds. My question, or not a question, a statement. I think I should begin by saying, my name is Khan. I've caught hatchery fish. I've caught them in Sitka. I've caught them in Ship Creek in Anchorage. I've caught them in the Clutner Raceway out in your area, Madam Chair, out in Kepler-Bradley Lakes. And if this bill were before us asking to generate funding from the general fund, I would be joining my colleagues to the right in their scrutiny and would likely be voting no. However, this is truly a user pay issue. Now, I know when we raise this fee, all the people who choose to buy a fishing license in the state, of course, will be subject to it. And as I indicated, I've fished in various areas of the state, and I suspect other residents do as well. But let me point out that the vast majority of the people who are paying this fee live on the rail belt. And whether my area, your area, or Fairbanks area, the vast majority of people that will be paying this fee are the most direct beneficiaries, and as is should be the case, they, of course, are going to be paying for it. So while all this discussion may be instructive, I think it's also important to point out that it is a user fee, and the beneficiaries are going to pay for it, and it is not going to fall to the general fund, and thereby reduce monies available to other subsidies.
Debbie, can there be taxation without representation? Just a minute. We've still got Senator Wilkin, please. Did you already ask your question? Okay, we're back to you, Senator Hoffman, and then we're back to you, Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. User pay. You know, that's the point that I was trying to come about. And again, this is not general fund, and still I'm scrutinizing it because I'm trying to find the equity in here for individuals in western areas of the state. And since the senator brought up user pay, we have coho salmon, 1.7 million coho salmon that are going to be going out there. What percentage of those coho salmon are going to be caught by commercial fishermen that are not going to be user payers of this fee?
I anticipate,
this is the department,
Senator, if I could ask part of it, because I asked that same question.
I can see the kings, but I don't see the coho.
Well, you know, I used to be able to catch landlocked coho salmon in Dune Lake. I haven't been there for a long time. I'm anticipating that we're going to get some back.
Well,
gentlemen.
Well, I'm looking at the Anchorage hatchery. These fish have to go out and to the sea and come back. And I can understand possibly the king salmon being earmarked and a high percentage of those being caught because you control the openings. but, you know, and we don't have very many king openings anymore, but how do you, getting back to Senator Bundy's question, the user, the commercial fishermen, how are they, what percentage of those 1.7 million calls in the Anchorage area are going to be caught by users of this fee?
Through the chair, this is Doug Nitzeling, Division of Sport Fish again. We looked at that. We've coated water tagged our fish, and we coated water tagged to make sure that we don't get straying as part of our disease policy and a variety of other things. In Cook Inlet, we found out that somewhere on the order of 85 to 90% of the coho salmon that are released in, for our anadromous releases are taught by sport fishermen. There is some percentage on an annual year that goes from 10 to 15% that is caught commercially, depending upon the openings. But again, the vast majority of those are caught by recreational anglers.
And well, those are non-users, right?
Recreational anglers?
Yeah, according to Senator Bundy's definition, 15% are non-users. They're not paying anything to this this program here.
Are there other questions? Because I'm going to, we're going to put this aside till Friday, and I've got someone in the audience that cannot testify, that needs to testify on another bill that will not be here, and I'm going to ask Kelly Hepler. Can you join us on Friday, Kelly?
Madam Chair, Kelly Hepler, Division of Sport Fish. I'm going to be out of state, madam, but I certainly can call in if you'd like me to have me, but otherwise I have very competent staff that you heard this morning concerning.
Okay, thank you. If you can have someone here, or if we need to, we'll get in touch with you. Thank you, Kelly.
Thank you, ma'am.
I have a couple of questions, too.
If I could just make a comment.
Senator Olson, yeah, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. And actually, this has to do with Senator Bundy's certain compelling conservative opinions that seem to be permeating down this side, and we're getting more and more conservative. I admit that. But I want to make it clear that I look at this bill, and I'm not against the bill necessarily. I think the debate is healthy. I think it's good, and so I want to make it clear to the sponsor that I'm keeping an open mind. I'm certainly not opposing the bill at this point.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Sherman, did you have your hand up?
I could wait. You know, I just want to go into the funding mechanism a little bit more, but I'll wait because. And then I'd also like it noted too that, you know, and I mentioned earlier that the concept chair I'm not opposed to. I've got some issues with funding. And I'd also like it to be noted that part of this program is in Senate District A, which we haven't even got to yet, but we can do that on Friday.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen. We'll work with both of you on Friday.
Yes, the babies are eating some of those salmon too, and maybe we should have a baby tax.
Good.
We'll go back to Senate Bill 158, and we have someone in the room that needs to testify today. Is that Steve? Is that you again? Okay, if you would come ahead and give us your testimony, and if you look in your packet, I think you'll find as well a letter from Steve Boyd, but he is here today and has to leave very shortly. So if you would go ahead and...
The title of the bill? Or the
well, we are back on 158, the mini tax on state construction contracts. Okay, go ahead, Steve, if you'd give us your testimony, please.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Steve Boyd, manager of the Alaska chapter of the National Electrical Contractors Association. We have approximately 30 members, and we represent another 40 contributing employers in our industry. We feel that the scope of state projects logically links the subcontractors to the general contractor, and therefore subcontract values should be exempt from local taxes. Bids on projects are typically solicited from general contractors for a total project, including subcontractor work and the coordination of their work thereof. Subcontractors can therefore only work for the state via this conduit established by the state and the general contractor in language that binds the subcontractor to the state as much as the general contractor is bound to the state. It's come to our attention that subcontractors have been charged local sales taxes, in particularly in the city of Nome assessed Diamond Electric subcontractor $20,000, a little over $20,000. A company by the name of Alaska Industrial Insulation and Fireproofing was billed a little over $6,100. Midnight Sun Services, Northland Tile, Arctic Striping, and Premier Construction on an airport project in Nome funded by the state of Alaska. Meanwhile, AirTech Incorporated, a Soldotna area contractor, was assessed a tax of $1,800 by the city of Sandpoint on a state airport project in the area of Sandpoint. We'd like to point out that this is a negative financial impact to the state and their projects. And just for an example, a tax or any other cost item of $20,000 assessed on a subcontractor would probably result in a markup. And for discussion's sake, it typically would run in the neighborhood of maybe 10%. So you now have a $22,000 item that the subcontractor has included in the bid to the general contractor, which again, the general contractor would perhaps mark that value of the subcontract up as they're part of their administration of it by 10%. So the state would see $24,200 increase in the project cost if this practice were allowed to continue. As an industry association, it's our goal to create a consistent and equitable practice statewide so everyone knows the rules. This is why we're here today after evaluating the steps the contractor himself took in seeking relief. We feel clarification of the statute would be in the best interest of the state and our industry.
Are there any questions for Steve on the process? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. As we looked at the quality contract, the quality asphalt contract, and the subcontractor Diamond Electric that was assessed a little over $20,000 tax, what was the total amount of the subcontract that Diamond was paid?
Through the chair, Senator, I believe it was about $419,000 total, in plus or minus a couple thousand.
$419,000. Thank you, Madam Chairman.
That completes your question, Senator Olson?
Yes, it does.
Okay, Senator Huggins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I apologize for not being here earlier. When we looked at what brought this bill about, there were essentially three elements of consideration. First, we heard about the experience of Diamond Electric and others in Nome. And as we queried about the different state agencies, it was clear that there was nothing clear in the minds of state organizations about what happened to businesses when they went to different communities to conduct and what their status was as far as taxes. That was the first part. Second is that at a minimum, it created an unstable, cloudy business environment when we go out or go to any community potentially in the future. And then when you filter all that, it wasn't right. And as I talked to people about the state, the practice wasn't right. Now, here's my concern, and I'll read you an email and leave out a couple names that let you know that this is not just a community that stumbled on an isolated practice, because I say to you it will be a growing practice. Here is from an individual to the director of the Municipal League. I think most communities that use as their legal firm, names of communities, have a policy of collecting sales tax from subcontractors doing business in their community, regardless of the funding source. Said another way, if you are the client of certain legal firms, this strategy will spread across the state. It will be very inflationary for the state, and this bill will fix that. And I think if you look about that, and in talking to most business leaders, they would prefer it be fixed rather than seeing the challenge of it trying to spread to their communities.
Senator Hogan, how many references or how many incidences have you heard, or how many different communities do you think are already involved?
There's at least three, and each of those three are the clients of this specified legal firm.
Okay.
Right.
Well, as time goes on and this becomes more and more common, would that impact what we would see in our state capital budget?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you can imagine we got from $430 to $500 million, as I recall, when we look at what's on the street in contracting. You take just take the 5% factor of that, you do the math, it's staggering what it would cost over time. And, of course, the other variable is that it goes based on what the local practice would be in the taxing, what their number was as far as a percentile.
So I would assume communities have chosen to use this as their mechanism to make up for other lost funds, or what they can see.
Well, I'm sure there are varying rationales. You know, the average Alaskan I talked to had about this perspective. We as Alaskans sent a project that we funded, $8 million worth, to a community, and they said that wasn't enough. We want another $21,900. They thought that was a bridge too far.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. Any other questions, Senator Olson? Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Certainly, as we looked at the emphasis of what particularly this administration is for local control, for local revenue generation, and looking at the multiple capital projects that have gone on in these communities, it's my, well, I know that there have been other projects that have been doing this for a number of years where they've been taxing the subcontractor. And to a certain degree, I would hope that Diamond had done some background check to know that this was going to be an added expense.
That they do what?
That they would have gone back and known that the city or the municipality that they were doing businesses in had a common practice of charging the sales tax to the subcontractor.
But then we should also know that when we're doing our capital budget.
I think that's one of the things that should be there, but with the emphasis that local control and local revenue generation, with that emphasis there, that needs to be taken into consideration, certainly, Madam Chair.
Senator Huggins.
Madam Chair, if I might, good point by Senator Olson. The difficulty here, and this it gets exactly to the point, is that Nome, in this case, in their practice, has been very inconsistent. It creates a very sketchy business environment because it can't be predicted. In some cases, they did tax, in some cases, they didn't tax. So it's not a consistent practice.
Senator Bundy.
Well, just a comment. You know, I certainly have a great appreciation for local control, but unfortunately, in some areas of Alaska, local control or local support seems to be defined as spending other people's money in lieu of your own contribution, and considering that a local contribution, I would suggest that without this bill, it seems as if I don't think it's too harsh to call it double dipping for people to get a state project and then try to make money off the state project. We need to reduce the size of state projects, so we have to make sure the money that we fund goes to the project and not to other financing mechanisms.
Just as a reminder, we have two people on teleconference that I want to be sure and get to. And then Senator Huggins has something to say, but before that, Senator Hoffman has a question.
Yes, well, more a comment, I guess. You know, I think that there should be uniformity in this area, and I think that this is brought to us primarily, I think, from Senator Olson's comment that the subcontractor was unaware of this, but there are other communities in the state that have sales tax, and I wonder if you looked at those communities, you know, Fairbanks, Wasilla, Bethel, Dillingham. There's a lot of communities that have sales tax. How are, you know, are those contractors that are going to these areas, are they just informed of this and pay the tax, and so we're not, so they know, they build those into their bids, or is it that those communities exempt these subcontractors, or what is happening? You know, this is an isolated case in Nome and in Sand Point, but what is the general practice throughout the state today? And you know, that's something I think that we need to know, and so we can make a uniform decision. And I'm saying this because I think it should be uniform, but many of those contractors, when they're going into small communities, do a lot of daily, require a lot of daily maintenance, repairing of the roads. You know, they come in with big equipment, and those roads have to be maintained by those communities. And on a normal day-to-day basis, the community may repair that road once a year. And when you have somebody coming in and with a lot of equipment and a subcontractor, that necessitates more than what their budget requires, you know, there should be some consideration to that aspect. So I'm just wondering what the practice is in other areas of the state.
Yeah.
Senator Higgins.
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, you hit precisely on the point. Is what we're talking about in the case of Nome, which we're discussing today, that case, it's an aberrational behavior. You mentioned Fairbanks, you mentioned Matsu and others. They do not have that practice. They do not tax the contractor.
Subcontractors.
Either one.
But if they went to the grocery store or to the restaurant,
absolutely,
meal or groceries,
absolutely,
or whatever,
absolutely,
they would pay the same tax that,
absolutely,
every resident pays.
Okay. Absolutely. This does not affect that.
I do need to go to the teleconference. We've got about 6 minutes before we need to adjourn. David Lance in Anchorage, if you could give your name and who you represent, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is David Lance, and I'm the owner and general manager of Diamond Electric. Just a little background on the project itself. We did the project in 2001, actually did the majority of the work in the summer of 2002. And it wasn't until mid-construction or even later, actually, that the city of Nome presented us with a tax bill that we were unaware of and did not have built into our bid. We've actually done many construction projects in Nome on the airport over the last 15 years, and has never been an issue before. It's actually a retail tax, so we didn't even consider ourselves as being a retail sales entity, I guess, when we're doing business with the state of Alaska and general contractors. We attempted to negotiate with the city, actually spent about another $11,000 on attorneys to argue our case with the city, but we were eventually presented with a tax lien, which for a contractor is not a good thing to have, so we were basically forced into paying the tax and the attorney fees. Total cost was over $30,000, which is had quite an impact on us, especially for that project. And as was mentioned, we did pay sales tax on at least $75,000 worth of business in the community for everything from groceries, room and board, things at the hardware store, concrete, rental of vehicles and equipment. So when we were taxed on our value of our subcontract, we were actually double taxed because we had already paid tax on almost 25% of that subcontract. I think most of the other points have been covered by Senator Huggins and the other folks that are involved in this bill, so I think I'll cut it off at that unless somebody has any questions for me. Thank you, ma'am.
Okay, Senator Olson does have a question for you. David?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. The primary contractor, obviously, in Nome has got a city permit to go ahead and do business there. Did you also purchase a building permit or any other permit from the city?
No, we did not.
Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Okay. Thank you, David, for testifying for us today. And we also have from the city of Nome, Denise, I don't know if that's Michelle or Michaels, Denise Michaels.
The mayor.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for giving me the opportunity to speak on this. The city of Nome obviously is opposed to the Senate bill.
We feel that this is a local option to raise revenue. Since 1990, revenue sharing has gone down to zero, and that's almost $500,000 of revenue that we need to create to be able to have our city operate. In between that, the city of Norm, also being responsible, raised our sales tax 1% in 04 to help offset these high costs. And this is a local option that our community chooses. We're not like the bigger communities of Fairbanks and Anchorage, where they have a very broad tax base where they can get additional revenue. We get our revenues primarily from sales tax and property tax. Our property tax here in Nome, 40% of the property is non-exempt by state statute. Yet everybody, even the contractors that come onto these jobs, utilize our services. When their people come into town, they're using our streets, our ambulance services, our police arrest their guys when they get unruly. And so we feel that this is a choice that works for us and it's fair for the city of Nome. I'm also a contractor, and I make sure I do my due diligence to make sure what fees there are, land fees, to operate a project in rural areas. And, I'm really sorry that what happened to Diamond Electric, but it states right in our codes on what we tax and what the fees are. So we just feel that this is really going to hurt us, that you're going to take away this option power that's invested in municipalities by state statute to raise revenue. The state of Alaska, through the Department of Education, takes a percentage of the grant for overhead. DOT does the same thing on projects, 5%. And that's for administrative fees. We feel that this helps us reduce our costs to operate the city business. I want to take the time to thank everybody, and I'm here if you have any questions.
Questions for Mayor Michaels? Thank you, Denise. See you later. Senator Huggins, I saw your hand go up.
Yeah, just a comment. Denise and I are certainly good friends and enjoyed the opportunity at the Diderot Start with her this year. She's a great lady and a great leader for the city of Nome. There is a distinct difference in the business of places like DOT have an administrative fee because they have a staff that oversees those functions like building the airport in Nome. So there's a distinct difference. And doing the airport in Nome is not reliant upon the structure of the government in Nome. It should be semi-invisible to them, but welcome, because you have people staying in motels and renting cars and eating in restaurants and things of that nature, which is, I think, was stated by Mr. Lance, about $75,000 that people spent in the local community as they did that.
Thank you very much. We are going to have to get to the floor. Kathy, I hope to meet you Friday. Okay, thanks. Mm-hmm. We will revisit this and other bills on Friday. We will recess to 5 p.m. Senator Wilkin, would you like to announce what we'll be doing at 5 p.m.?
Thank you, ma'am. 5 o'clock, we're going to have statewide teleconference on off-net sites, 5 to 5:30 on the operating budget, and then 5:30 to 6:30 Juno, and whoever else would like to join us around the state. Thank you.
Thank you. With that, we are recessed until 5 p.m. today. Thank you very much.